Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, and welcome back. Or if you're new around here, hi, my name's Georgia, and on my platforms on the internet, I talk about true crime. Sometimes I talk about unsolved cases, and sometimes, like today, I talk about solved cases. Today we're going to be talking about a case from here in the UK, the solved case of 25-year-old Joanna Yates. If you're from here, then you've probably heard of Joanna's story before, or if not the story, then you definitely would have seen her face before. This was one of those true crime stories that just became huge in the media. But as always tends to be the case when our British tabloids are involved, they cause a lot of problems. One day, I would love to talk about a British case where it just wasn't completely destroyed by the tabloids, but that day is yet to come. But we'll get into all that later in the episode. First, I just want to talk about Jo. Joanna Yates was a 25-year-old woman who had everything going for her. She'd grown up in Ampfield in Hampshire with her parents David and Teresa and her brother Chris, and she was just so incredibly loved by everyone who knew her. She's been described as a very bright, happy-go-lucky type person who always had time for everyone. She loved being outdoors and she loved playing sports, but also was just this incredibly gifted person. She was very, very smart, and had her life not been taken away from her, there's no doubt that she would have gone on to do some really great things. I know, it's really cliche to say these kinds of things about victims, but with Jo, it was just the truth. She went to the University of Gloucestershire, where she graduated in July 2010 with a distinction. She was studying to become a landscape architect, which is really no mean feat. Her course tutor said that Jo was just one of those students who you could tell was destined for really great things. Her death was a huge loss to everyone. She was very well liked and she was admired by her peers. She was a very gifted student and a high achiever in everything that she did. And upon graduating, it obviously didn't take long for Jo to find a job in landscape design, settling on BDP in Bristol, which meant she had to move to a whole new city, start her life afresh. This was a very exciting time of life for Jo, and of course she would have been nervous, but there's no doubt her nerves were alleviated by the fact that her boyfriend of 2 years, 27-year-old Greg Reardon, was moving with her. Anyone who knew this pair said they were just soulmates, they were meant to be together, and they were so, so happy. Jo's best friend said that she was just besotted with Greg and she hated to be apart from him. So they officially moved in to flat 1 at 44 Canning Road in Clifton, Bristol on October 25th, 2010, and they were just so excited to be starting this new chapter in their lives. 44 Canning Road had previously been this very, very large house that was now converted into 6 flats. You walk in the front door to a shared foyer, and entrances to the ground floor apartments are on the bottom, with a stairway to the upper floor apartments. A man called Christopher Jeffries, a retired English teacher, had lived in one of these upper flats since the 90s, and in 2001 the opportunity came up for him to buy the 2 ground floor flats, which were flats 1 and 2, making him Jo and Greg's landlords. The two moved in and they just had no problems. They were really, really happy with their flat, with the building, with the area they lived in. Everything was going really well for them. So when the weekend of the 17th of December 2010 rolled around and Greg had plans to go back home to visit his family in Sheffield, Jo was pretty nervous. She hadn't spent a night alone at the flat yet and she was just dreading it. And she told her work friends as much when she popped to the pub with them after work that day. That morning, she'd kissed Greg goodbye and she told her colleagues that she had plans to just spend the entire weekend distracting herself. She was going to bake bread and cakes, and they told her, make sure you bring some into work on Monday morning. And like, everything was completely normal. Jo was like, yeah, I will absolutely bring some stuff in. She had just 1 pint of cider at the pub and then started on her walk home, popping into some shops en route. First, she went into a Waitrose where I don't think she bought anything, and then she went to a Bargain Booze off license where she picked up a couple of bottles of cider. And then finally, at 8:40 p.m., she goes into a Tesco Express where she picks up an oven pizza for dinner. Her entire journey home was later meticulously pieced together through security footage. Whilst walking, she also called her best friend, as we all do when we're walking on our own. They chatted for a bit and made plans to see each other in just a few days on Christmas Eve. And then she heads home, and after this point, we don't know the exact timeline of events. We know she got home on the Friday night, and then we know she vanished. Greg would spend the next day, the Saturday, trying to get in contact with Jo, but she wasn't replying to any of his messages, nor was she answering the phone. Now, she was apparently notoriously bad at replying to her messages. It wasn't really unusual for her to go off grid for a couple of days, but not necessarily with Greg when he's away. Like, I'm also pretty bad at replying to messages, but I'll always prioritise my fiancé over anyone else. Like, I will reply to her, I'll answer her calls, whilst just forgetting everyone else's. That's just how relationships work. You stay in touch, particularly when they're away. So Greg was understandably quite concerned. Some sources even say he headed home early from Sheffield to check in on her, but I'm not entirely sure how correct that is. What I do know is he arrived back at their Bristol flat on Sunday evening and straight away noticed that things were a little bit off. Like, all of Jo's belongings were still in the home, but there was no sign of her. So he calls her mobile and hears it ringing inside the flat. Not wanting to panic right away, he decides to wait for a little bit for her to come home. Like, maybe she'd gone out with a friend and just forgot to take her phone. And so he sat and waited. He drank a half-empty bottle of cider that he found in the kitchen and cooked a pizza that he took out of the freezer, which was a different pizza to the one that Jo had bought on the Friday night. But when it came round to midnight and she still wasn't home, he phoned the police to report her as a missing person. Before this point though, he'd called both his own mother and Jo's mother to ask them if they'd heard anything, if they maybe knew where Jo was, but they didn't. Now, Greg knew his girlfriend well and knew that this was completely out of character for her. Jo wouldn't just go wandering off on her own without her phone and her keys. So he waited and hoped that maybe he was just overreacting, but it soon did become clear that that just wasn't the case. Jo was gone. And luckily, the police did agree straight away that something seemed off. They did take the disappearance very seriously immediately. They also had a feeling that something bad had happened here and they launched a missing persons inquiry straight away. The next day, Monday, December 20th, Avon and Somerset Police made their first appeal for any information in Jo's disappearance. This very quickly became this huge police search and the media did pick up on it. There wasn't a person in the UK who didn't know of Jo's disappearance. I would have been 16 myself at this time and I remember it so clearly. Jo's face was everywhere. Professionals searched the local Bristol Downs and the Avon Gorge just in case she'd maybe fallen in there, and then they started to interview the people in Jo's life. Now, I know what you're thinking, it's always a boyfriend, and of course they did speak to Greg, but he really was away in Sheffield. Multiple people, including his family, were able to confirm that this was true. Jo was also undoubtedly seen alive by people who knew her and on CCTV long after Greg had left for Sheffield, so he was definitely innocent, and he was very quickly cleared of having anything to do with her disappearance. So this left him free to make his own appeals for Jo alongside her parents, who spoke at a police press conference for the very first time on December 21st. They then made a second appeal 2 days later, revealing that they were worried that Jo had been abducted. They urged the public to come forward if they had any information at all. And alongside the very public appeals, investigators were also working very hard behind the scenes, piecing together the timeline of Jo's evening through the security footage on her route home. Specialist officers also searched the flat and they found nothing in there that necessarily indicated any foul play, but they did find the Tesco Express receipt from the pizza Jo had bought on the Friday evening. However, very strangely, there was no sign of the pizza itself or the box. Now, this would become one of the focal points of this investigation because what had happened to the pizza box? Jo had very clearly arrived home with it, but it was nowhere to be seen. Why would somebody remove this from the scene? They were sure that finding this pizza or the pizza box would provide a lot of clarity for the investigation, but spoiler alert, they never would. Another important thing that was noted was there was zero sign of any forced entry to the flat. There was no damage to the windows or the doors, and that's both the door to the flat and the entrance door to the wider building. To investigators, this suggested that Jo must have known whoever took her or hurt her. She felt comfortable enough to let this person into her flat. And that narrowed down the suspect pool here quite significantly. Police were looking closely at the people who were around Jo every day and who was closer to her than her neighbours. They'd already knocked on the door of her neighbour Vincent Tabak at flat 2 at 4 a.m. on the first night of the search, and he denied having any knowledge of Jo's disappearance. He said he hadn't seen or heard anything. He actually barely knew his neighbours, he said. Greg and Joanna had only moved in just a couple of months beforehand, and apart from running into each other in the hallway, the neighbours just hadn't really had much to do with each other at all. Some sources say they'd never even run into each other in the hallway, that just they'd never ever seen each other at all in the 2 months they both lived there, and honestly, I can probably believe that. As a precaution though, of course, the police searched his flat and they found nothing of concern, so they quickly moved their attention somewhere else, namely to the landlord, Christopher Jeffries. Now, Christopher set off alarm bells in the mind of investigators because he was just a bit of an odd man. He was a bit socially awkward, he didn't really seem to leave his flat all that often, he was just a bit weird. He lived on one of the upper floors, and it was noted that being the landlord, he was the only person other than the tenants who had keys to access the flat. He could easily have entered without forcing his way in. But at this point in time, Jo's case was just being treated as a missing persons case, and she wasn't in his flat when they searched, so they couldn't really focus on him too much. On Christmas Eve, the police released the security footage showing Jo buying the pizza in the Tesco Express on the night of the 17th. They were still very much focusing in on this pizza. It just seemed baffling that this had disappeared alongside Jo, but the evidence showed that she definitely made it home. Her boots and coat that she was wearing that day were inside the flat. Her phone, her keys were inside the flat. It wasn't like somebody abducted her, pizza and all, on the way home. No, she got home and then somebody entered and took her and the pizza. It was just really, really strange. The next day was Christmas morning, which as you can imagine was incredibly painful for the Yates family and for Greg. The pair had originally had plans to go and visit their families over Christmas. Just a week earlier they'd been so excited to celebrate with everyone, and in just a number of days their entire lives had changed. It's terrifying that from week to week, day to day, we never know how much our lives are going to be different. But it's even more difficult when it comes to the Christmas season, a time dedicated to spending your time with your loved ones, with your family. The Yateses were devastated. They weren't going to be able to celebrate this without Jo there. But then, on Christmas Day, the family received the call that they'd been dreading. It seemed like Jo's body had been found. Two walkers had been out on Christmas morning with their dogs when they came across a body partially buried in the snow on Longwood Lane. Now, Longwood is a very quiet road. It's surrounded by nature, lots of greenery, and is fenced off on either side. It's also home to Dunford Quarry, which is separated from the road by a wall. Bloodstains on the wall close to where the body was found seem to suggest that the killer had attempted to lift her over the fence into the quarry, but then they just gave up and just decided to dump her on the side of the road and covered the body with leaves. The killer would have known that she was going to be found eventually, it was just a matter of time. And it's really interesting to me that the killer, whoever they were, had this idea to dispose of the body in the quarry. And had they succeeded, it's highly likely that it wouldn't ever have been found, and this case may still be unsolved today. But they didn't have an equally effective plan B. When the quarry plan failed, they just left the body where she was, just on the side of the road, knowing that she'd very soon be found. There was no effort to bury her or even try something else, just left on the side of the road, which is great for us, great for investigators, and great for her family. But it's a very interesting thought process for the killer, isn't it? On Boxing Day, so December 26th, the police announced that they were satisfied that the body was definitely that of Jo Yates. And 2 days later, after the post-mortem had taken place, they announced that her cause of death was strangulation. Now, this was officially upgraded from a missing persons investigation to a murder investigation. post-mortem would reveal that Joe had suffered 43 separate injuries, multiple cuts and bruises, and a fractured nose. She had tried to fight back against her attacker. She was pinned to the floor by her wrists. She had injuries to her head, nose, neck, abdomen, and both arms and both legs. Awfully, the evidence would reveal that her death would have likely been slow and painful. When her body was found, she was fully clothed for the most part. Her jeans were on and fastened, but her pink top had been partially pulled up over her head. She was also still wearing her bra, but her right breast had been exposed. She was found wearing only one sock, a size 5 grey ski sock, and the other sock was nowhere to be found. It definitely wasn't back at the flat. So alongside the pizza, searching for this sock became a top priority because investigators knew if they found it, it would likely share a lot of information. Jo wasn't wearing any shoes or coat when she was found, which matched the investigators' main theory since the beginning, that she had been abducted directly from her flat. But like I said, the sock was the main focus here. Detectives said it could have been kept by the murderer as a trophy, or maybe even it was the murder weapon. Maybe it was used to strangle her. It was a very long sock. They wanted to keep open minds to all possibilities, they said. With the investigation now turning up a notch to a murder case, extra officers were brought in to help with this search. By the first week of January, 80 detectives, uniformed officers and civilian staff were now working on this, alongside many outside experts who were also brought in. They were working following up on around 1,000 lines of inquiry, they examined over 1,000 hours of CCTV footage, and they seized 293 tons of rubbish from the area and sifted through it all. A witness eventually came forward saying that she'd been attending a party at a neighbour's house on the night in question at number 53. This was kind of diagonally opposite the flats. The witness said that she was walking towards the house shortly after 9 p.m. when she heard two loud screams coming from the direction of the flats. Another neighbour who lived behind said that he heard a woman scream, "Help me," at some point in the night, although he was never able to pinpoint exactly what time he heard this. Other neighbours reported hearing nothing at all. But it didn't really matter that much because by this point of the investigation, they'd already made an arrest. Remember the aforementioned awkward landlord, Christopher Jeffries? He'd been arrested just 5 days after Joe's body had been found. He was the only other person who had a key to the flat. It made sense. And from this moment on, this became a case of trial by media. At 7 a.m. on the 30th of December, Christopher Jeffries had been arrested at his flat. He spent Christmas away at a cousin's house, and so he was very shocked when he came home, and police turned up to arrest him on suspicion of murder. He was completely blindsided. He didn't even know who was being looked at in relation to this case. He was just the landlord living in the same building. He thought that was it. He was taken to the police station for questioning, and the way the law works here in the UK is they can hold you for up to 24 hours for questioning before they either have to charge you with a crime or release you. However, if you're suspected for more serious crimes such as murder, they can hold you for up to 36 or 96 hours, but they do have to apply for permission to do this from the magistrate, which is exactly what they did in Christopher's case. In order to do this, they told the magistrate that Chris had given two contradictory statements, when in reality, all he'd done was add more information to his original statement after further questioning. There were no actual contradictions. The police really were going all in on Christopher, but really, they had no evidence against him. He was simply a slightly odd, eccentric-looking guy, and that's what they were making their judgments off of. Well, that and the fact that Greg remembered speaking to Christopher as he left on the Friday and he told him he was going away, so Christopher would have known that Joe was going to be home alone that weekend, but like that was all they had. Luckily for Christopher though, DNA evidence had been found on Joe's body. Tiny bits of DNA, but DNA nonetheless. It was found in quite an odd spot, on the jeans, on sort of like the underside of her knees, as if somebody had either dragged her by the legs or held her under the legs as she was carried away. More DNA was also found on the right breast, and none of it was a match to Christopher Jeffries, so he was quickly released on the 1st of January. But he was still kept on police bail for 6 weeks, despite the fact there was literally zero evidence against him. It was fine for the police to arrest him if they had suspicion, they had to question him, but the fact that they let the media treat him as they did and stayed silent, that was a very big issue. Obviously, as Joe's disappearance and murder attracted such intense media attention, as soon as Mann was arrested, they were all over it. This regular man became a victim of the awful British tabloid media. I know I say it all the time, but our tabloid media is just the worst. They really do not care about the well-being of anyone, as long as they can write headlines and sell newspapers. Christopher was just the latest in a long line of tabloid victims. And if you really want to understand, like, just how deeply this goes, I recommend going to watch my video on the phone hacking scandal. That sort of, like, explains everything. Christopher has since said that the person written about in the media was somebody that he just didn't recognise. They made up this entire character and sold papers on the back of it. They said he was creepy, a loner, strange, lewd, and obsessed with death. They painted a picture that made it hard for the public to believe that he could be innocent. And even once there was no DNA match, literally no evidence against him, the police released him on bail free of charge. And you can imagine what the press inferred from that. It didn't exactly come across like he was innocent. The police bail wouldn't be released until early March, long after the actual perpetrator was found and arrested. The police would later be forced to apologise. They said they should have made it clearer at the time that Christopher was no longer being considered a suspect in this case, that he was innocent, but they didn't, and so he had to face all this vitriol from not just the media, but everyone else as well. He would later say in interviews that at the time he was arrested, he was just numb with shock. The arrest for him came out of nowhere. He was angry at what was happening as he knew he was innocent, but nobody believed him. The police, the media, the public, it was very much a trial by newspaper. I can't imagine there's a more frustrating situation than knowing you're innocent of a crime but not being believed, feeling like everyone is working against you. I dread to think what might have happened to Christopher if no DNA had been found on Joe's body. Like, would this have gone further? Upon being released on bail, Christopher was forced to go and stay with friends because he just couldn't go back to the flat. He went into hiding, he changed his very distinctive appearance, and he only left the house under the cover of darkness. You can imagine that would have quite a toll on a person, like being scared to go out in case somebody decides to commit some form of vigilante justice, being followed by the press every time you leave the house. I know Christopher isn't the victim in this case, like Joe is the victim, but he very nearly became a secondary victim. His life was wildly affected just because he was judged by the police and the media on appearances and personality, not on actual evidence, of which there just wasn't any. The 3 days he spent being questioned was time wasted. On the 2nd of January, police released a statement warning women not to walk home alone after dark, fearing that the perpetrator would strike again. Patrols were also stepped up in the Clifton area. A couple of days later, an advert was placed on Facebook appealing for any witnesses, an advert that was viewed over 250,000 times. That's a huge amount of eyes on Joe's name. Police were also working with BBC's Crime Watch to make a reconstruction of Joe's disappearance in the hope this would reach even more people. I mean, even just the news coverage about them filming this reconstruction brought in over 300 new leads. But the reconstruction itself would never air because just a number of hours before it was due to go out to the public, police were able to get a DNA match to none other than Vincent Tabak, Joe's neighbour of flat number 2. Now, he'd been on their radar for a little bit already at this point. After Joe's disappearance, him and his girlfriend Tanya had actually flown to the Netherlands for the New Year. He was a Dutch national, and whilst he was there, he'd been very closely following the investigation back home. He was constantly looking online to see what was going on. And it must have been constant, because just 3 hours after Christopher was arrested, Tabak sees this as an opportunity to call the investigators and let them know some information that he'd only just remembered. He said that on the evening Joe went missing, he remembered looking outside and seeing Christopher's car parked on the driveway, facing away from the road. The next morning, when he looked out again, the car was in the same spot, but was facing the opposite direction, towards the road now, obviously indicating that during the night, Christopher had driven it, when he said he'd only been at home. He was just wondering if this would help out with the investigation, he said. And this intrigued the investigators, so much so that literally the day after, on New Year's Eve, they flew a detective out to Amsterdam to meet with Tabak in a hotel so they could interview him again. As Joe's direct neighbour, it was very important they had every detail of his story. But it soon became very clear to the detective that he wasn't being entirely truthful. The details of his accounts were confused. He was very vague about some things and very detailed about others. He said at one point that he'd gone out twice that evening, and then he said that he may have set foot in Joanna's hallway whilst chatting to the landlord, so if they found DNA, that might be why. He also seemed just a bit too interested in the forensics of the investigation. He was asking a whole load of questions, which was weird because when they asked him to provide his own DNA just so he could be ruled out, he was very, very reluctant. They did eventually manage to convince him to provide it, but he just really, really did not want to. And I know not everyone wants the government to have their DNA, and that's a legitimate concern, but when you're dealing with a murder investigation and your DNA is going to help maybe rule you out, you provide it. The only reason people ever show hesitation at providing their DNA in this scenario is because they're guilty. And what would you know, his DNA would turn out to match that found on Joe's body. It was actually quite a tricky process to get to this point. Although the DNA swabs did match tobacco, they said, they weren't of sufficient quality to be evaluated, and I really don't quite understand how this works. Like, maybe it was a match but it wouldn't have held up in court, I don't know. But what I do know is they had to deploy a different method of analysis called DNA Sense. They had to basically purify and concentrate the sample to enhance it, and then they were able to say it was definitely a match. The probability of this not being a match with Vincent Tabak was less than 1 in a billion. And they were also unable to say what kind of DNA it was. They don't know if it was touch, semen or saliva, but they do know it was a match. Tabak was kept in custody and questioned for 96 hours before being officially charged on the 22nd of January 2011 with the murder of Joanna Yates. On the 25th, he declined to request bail and he was subsequently moved from Bristol Prison to Long Larton Prison, where he was placed on suicide watch. He was not in a good way. Initially, he refused to admit to the murder, saying that corrupt police had planted his DNA, but on the 8th of February, he would approach the prison chaplain and he confessed, saying that he'd killed Joe and intended to plead guilty. But let me tell you a little bit about who Vincent Tabak was. He was born in 1978 in the South Netherlands, making him 32 years old at the time of the murder. A look into his past shows a man who was always a bit of a loner, maybe somebody who struggled with social interaction and never really played with other children. He never really had many friends. He was a very, very smart man. He even had a PhD, but he just never really developed those social skills, and he always struggled with women, finding relationships with them difficult for most of his life. He moved to the UK in 2007 after accepting a job in Bath, and he seemed to come into himself a little bit more at this point. He got into his first proper relationship with a woman called Tanya, who he met through The Guardian's online dating site, Soulmates. Him and Tanya eventually moved in together into the Canning Road flat in July 2009, which was over a year before Joe and Greg would eventually move in. After his arrest, Tabak's car, mobile phone and laptop would all be seized by the authorities. And if the DNA wasn't enough, what investigators would find through searching these would really be the nail in his coffin. We'll start with his car, a silver Renault Megane, in which they found traces of Joe's blood in the boot. Fibres found on Joe's body would also indicate that she had come into contact with this car, as well as Tabak's black coat. That's pretty solid forensic evidence. More circumstantial stuff was found on the phone and laptop, but all of this was still pretty damning. Just 6 days before Joe's death, he'd used Google Street View and was looking at Longwood Lane, particularly at the part where Joe's body would later be found. Considering that this was a pretty empty area, he couldn't really have had many reasons to be looking at this on Street View, apart from maybe premeditation. In the days after Joe's death, he'd searched for topics like how long does a body take to decompose and the dates of refuse collection in this area. He looked up the differences between murder and manslaughter and the definition of sexual assault, none of which is really screaming innocent to me. He'd also been using his laptop to view violent pornography, showing a particular affiliation to anything depicting women being choked during sex. He was even watching these videos on the morning of Joe's murder. During their police investigation, they came across images of a woman who held a striking resemblance to Joe. She was wearing a pink top that had been pulled up to expose her breasts, incredibly similar to how Joe had been found. And despite being in a long-term committed relationship, Tabak had also used his computer to research escort agencies, and he'd contacted several of them by phone as well. When he'd gone on a work trip to the US in early November, he'd even met up with a sex worker at a motel. Isolated, this isn't necessarily a warning sign, but as a whole picture, this does become concerning. This was a man obsessed with sex, watching violent pornography that reinforces a view of women as objects. Objects there simply to satiate his own sexual desire. However, frustratingly, this evidence surrounding the pornography would be inadmissible at trial. The jury wouldn't know any of this. Although, as a quick side note, after the trial, it would be found that images of children had also been found on his laptop, for which he was prosecuted in 2015. He pled guilty to possessing more than 100 indecent images of children, to which he was only sentenced to 10 months in prison, which, spoiler alert, was to run alongside his existing sentence, which, if you ask me, just wasn't enough. So, after confessing to the prison chaplain, Tabak would eventually plead guilty to manslaughter. He said he killed Joe by accident. However, the prosecution refused to believe this version of events. They believed this was intentional and sexually motivated, and so they took it to court for murder. The timeline put forward at trial, beginning the 4th of October 2011, painted a picture of a man who was cold and calculated, a man who was fascinated by his beautiful neighbour and so decided to end her life, sex as the motivation. It was pure luck for him that on the 17th of December, not only was Greg away, leaving Joe home alone for the first time, but his own girlfriend Tanya was also at a work party that she wasn't going to be home from until the early hours of the morning. Without a true version of events from Tabak, we'll likely never know the minute details of that night. He probably watched Joe get home and waited a second before knocking on her door, making an excuse as to why he had to come inside. And then broad 6'4" Tabak, towering over Joe, quickly overpowered her. He pinned her to the floor by her wrists and she struggled against him. In his defence, he claimed that the killing had not been sexually motivated. He said that he tried to kiss her after she made a flirty comment and asked if he wanted a drink. He said that he was sexually naive, he thought she was interested. He tried to kiss her, causing her to scream, and as he tried to silence her, he accidentally strangled her to death. He denied there being any struggle, saying that he held her with minimal force around the neck for 20 seconds. This man has a PhD. You don't think that he knew that strangling someone for 20 seconds causes death. This also doesn't match with the 43 injuries found on her body. This is just yet another man who believes that a woman owes them sex. Yet another woman killed because she dared say no to a man who came onto her. Joe didn't do anything wrong. Even if you do believe that Joe let him in and offered him a drink, she was probably just being friendly to a neighbour. He probably made some sort of excuse as to why he needed to come in. Maybe he said he'd forgotten his key. Maybe he needed to borrow an egg. When women say it's all men, this is what we mean. Not every man is going to hurt us, we know that, but we never know which ones it'll be. Sometimes it'll be our neighbour that we've never spoken to. Sometimes it'll be the friend that we've known for a decade. Sometimes it'll be a stranger that we just smiled at on the street. Joe is just one of a long list of women hurt by a man who thought that she owed him something. He says that he thought she was flirting with him, so he tried to kiss her, just straight off the bat, tried to kiss her. When she screamed, he killed her. That is his good version of events. That is what he thought is going to get him off this. He thought that she was flirting with him, so sure, it was fine that he killed her. After killing her, Tabak said that he went into a state of panic and dumped the body, but the evidence doesn't show that. The evidence here shows planning, an attempt to make himself an alibi. He bundled Joe's body into the boot of his car before driving to the local Asda, where he went in and bought crisps and beer. Once there, he texts his girlfriend that he's bored and he misses her. He then drives to Longwood Lane where he dumps the body, probably after trying and failing to get it over to the fence into the quarry, something that he'd looked at on Google Maps just 6 days beforehand. The jury were sent out to deliberate on the 26th of October and returned with a verdict 2 days later. Vincent Tabak was found guilty of the murder of Joanna Yates by a 10-2 majority verdict. At sentencing, he was given a life sentence with a minimum of 20 years. The judge believed that there was a sexual element to this murder, and Joe's parents have said that they hoped that his time in prison would be a living hell. And I must admit, I very much share their sentiment. In regards to the missing pizza and sock, the two things the investigation seemed to focus on the most, they've never been found. However, the trial did maybe shed some light on their whereabouts, maybe. Tabak admitted that he did eat pizza on the night in question, he just denies it was Joe's. He claims that he took the pizza and its box from the flat after killing her and dumped it in a local bin. However, the prosecution thinks he ate it because it wasn't found in any of the rubbish that they searched. I suppose with the perpetrator being found now, the whereabouts of the pizza in its box just doesn't really matter. They just wanted to find it in the investigation in the hopes that it would lead to the killer, but they found him without it. But if he did kill her, dumped her body, went back and took her pizza out of the flat and then took it back to his flat and ate it? Like, that's just a whole other level of cold. It's so dismissive, isn't it? Like, oh, I'm just going to kill this woman, then I'm going to take the pizza that she bought to eat for her own dinner and I'm going to eat it myself. Like, what? In terms of the sock, Tabak claims that the sock fell off in the flat and after he moved her body, he went back to her flat, picked it up and put it in the same bin. Again, a very simple explanation, it just wasn't found in the search. Honestly, I don't know how to finish an episode like this. Just the sheer amount of female rage it fills me with is almost overwhelming. Joe didn't deserve this. Nobody deserves this. At the hands of yet another man who decided that she didn't deserve to live, that his need for sex was more important than her right to life. It's the same story we see over and over again, the story that never ever seems to change. Tabak insists that it wasn't sexually motivated, but even his version of events here is that he thought that she was flirting, so he tried to kiss her, and when she said no, he grabbed her to silence her, to keep her quiet so she didn't scream, and that's how she ended up dying. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but is that not still in some way sexually motivated? He tried to kiss her, she said no, she died. Joe deserved better. Every woman that this has happened to deserves better. It's the same story, as I said, again and again and again, and nobody is doing anything about it. Women are screaming about it from the rooftops, and still society is reluctant to change. Society is reluctant to listen to women when they are telling you what is happening. As I said earlier on in the video, it's not every man. We know it's not every man, but we don't know which men it is. Joe probably didn't know that day when she let Vincent Tabak, her neighbour that she'd run into in the hallway, into her flat for whatever reason, for whatever excuse he made. She didn't know that he was about to kill her. How would she have known that? But he did. I know this has been quite a heavy one, but thank you so much for watching today. If you like what I'm doing here on my channel, then please make sure you interact with this video in any way you can. Leave a comment, give it a like. If you're not subscribed already, make sure you hit that subscribe button. If you are feeling extra supportive, maybe you can become a channel member for just £2.99 a month. That gets you early access to videos, it gets you priority case requests. It means that I can see you leaving your comments and I'll make sure to reply. And it means you can help support me on my channel here. I need all the help I can get at keeping this going. I really, really want to continue being able to tell these stories. And right now, I need your help to do that. So if you are able to become a channel member, that would be amazing. If not, no pressure. Just leave a comment, like the video, do whatever you can to help. And I'll see you in the next one. Bye, guys.